Welcome to episode 49 of Good Timing with me, your host, Isabel Hagen. How's it going, folks? I'm doing really well today, and I'm not saying that to brag. I'm just saying it to say it. I feel very at peace today and woke up just with a lot of gratitude, and I don't always feel that way, but when I do feel good, this happens. I always say, well, this is how it's going to be from here on out. Man, I figured it out, didn't I? Good for me. And I don't expect that that will be the case. As I have in the past, move through these good moods and then move to more of a middle ground or to a shit mood. But just how good moods don't last forever, bad moods also don't last forever. So noticing all of these moods and how they come and go is very comforting for me. And I can sort of take solace in the fact that it's all a flow and an influx. And I sound like a, I don't know. Okay, today's guest, he's one of my favorite people. He always makes me feel in a good mood when I talk to him. It's stand-up comedian Shafi Hossein. He's a good friend of mine. He's a newer friend. We met through our mutual comedian friend, Joe List, who you probably know if you're a comedy fan or if you're a fan of this podcast. Joe was on an earlier episode. Anyway, but this is not about Joe. This is about Shafi, all right? Shafi Hossein. He's such a great guy. He's very into stoicism, and he is someone I always enjoy running into at shows. And he and I are actually doing a show together on Thursday, April 29th at 8:30 p.m. in Madison, New Jersey, at a place called Central and Main. So you can come out and check out that show. I think you can get tickets on the website for Central and Main in Madison, New Jersey. So it's a big Shafi week for me and for you if you listen to the podcast and come to the show. Shafi, in addition to being a comedian, is also an engineer. So that's pretty cool. We talk about the process of being an engineer and how it is similar to the process of being a stand-up, the writing process, the process of trial and error, of discovery, taking a scientific approach to stand-up, which I love talking about, I think is very interesting. So you'll hear more about that. And yeah, Shafi is just a great guy, funny comedian. You're going to love him. You're going to love this episode. I think we should get right to it. You can follow Shafi on Instagram and Twitter at Shafi Stands Up. That's S-H-A-F-I, Shafi Stands Up. Instagram and Twitter. Check him out. And as always, you can rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast platform. It really, really helps getting those ratings in. I feel like trash every time I ask, but it would be great if you could just, you know, pop open the app and hit the 5 stars, and you don't even have to write anything, you know, just the 5 stars is fine. If you want to write something, that'd be nice. You can write whatever you want. You can write how you're feeling. You can write how you feel about the podcast. You can write a poem. I don't know. Let's have fun with this, right? Okay, I think we're going to get to the episode now. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Shafi Hossein. No, I usually wear my pajama shirt on my podcast. I'm usually in my jammies. But I'm doing another podcast after this, and then I'm heading out for the day. And I was like, you know what? Let me suit up, and just maybe this will give me some energy that I need right now because I'm a little out of it. And
it is kind of exciting. It is kind of true though. Like when you dress up, you immediately feel more confident. Do you feel that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yet I rarely do it. I'm usually like, oh, I feel so good right now. I'm going to always do this. And the next day I'm like, but is feeling good really that great? I don't know. I'd rather just stay in my...
Now the cape makes sense. You know, like I have always wondered, like, why do superheroes have to wear a costume? And they're like, oh, it's because you have to get into the mindset of saving people. You can walk around all you want. You're like, oh, I can save them. But without the attire, you're like, yeah, I don't feel it. I don't feel confident enough.
Did you dress up as superheroes a lot as a kid?
I did not dress up as superheroes a lot. I did dress up as Prince Ram once. You probably don't know who that is. Prince Ram is a prince of Indian mythology, and he had like a sword. And it's the funniest. Like we had like a Halloween competition in my school in Bangladesh, and I chose to be him, and he had like a big plastic sword that I had to gather, and I did, but my parents were mad at me, so they broke it.
They broke your sword?
They broke my sword.
Were they were mad at you for something else, or they were mad at you for dressing up
as they weren't mad at for, no, they bought it with their money.
Right.
And they wasted it. Because I did something that they didn't want me to do. Completely different. But they know how to hurt you where it matters. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they killed your weapon.
Yeah,
Were you a naughty kid?
I was a naughty kid. I think I was a very sweet child, but I also wanted to like play outside a lot. And obviously, you know, parents are very, like, they don't feel safe a lot if you're just like walking around on your own, especially in Bangladesh. There's like always, you know, things going wrong or whatever. You see the news and you're like panicking.
Right.
But yeah, I was just like, I just wanted to play cricket. That's all I wanted to do when I was a kid. I was like, I want to be a cricket player. That never panned out.
Did you early on consider yourself, like, were you going to be like an athlete or more? Did you always know you were going
to
do comedy?
I always wanted to be an athlete. Yeah. I wanted to be a cricket player, but, you know, I just didn't have it. I went to a cricket academy one day, and then my mom like pulled the plug. She's like, there's no way you can't do it. You got to study to be like a doctor or engineer, like the classic, you know, South Asian parenting.
Right.
And, you know, then I followed up with that and I ended up being an engineer because, you know, I couldn't make it in cricket. So that was my fallback plan, which is what I did.
Well, you could have done what you're doing now, which is try to make it in cricket while also being an engineer, because you are, you know, pursuing comedy.
Right.
While also working full time as an engineer.
Yeah, because the only way I could have done that is if I wanted to do cricket, I would also had to travel like 9,000 miles away from my parents so that they would have no idea what I'm doing.
Right.
Because that's how I started comedy, because I was, you know, 9,000 miles away from them. I still am.
So when did you move to the States?
I moved to the States 9 years ago now. So when I was 18, that's when I moved. I was like, for college, I moved there to study. And then after college, I was like, oh, I have too much free time and I don't like that. So I started doing comedy and I fell in love with it.
And when did you, or have you still not told your parents that you do comedy?
Oh, they know. They know I do comedy. But most parents, I feel like all they want is that their kids are safe and stable. And like, I have a job, so they don't care. You can do whatever you want as long as you can provide. And don't ask for money. That's all. That's the motivation, you know.
Right. So I wanted to ask you, what was the moment where you realized that comedy was something you loved and or wanted to actually do yourself?
In college, I loved watching stand-up comedy. I had no idea that we actually had like a stand-up night. And it's such a big college, so I had no idea that that was a thing. But I always watched it. And then after college, when I moved upstate, Saratoga Comedy Works is my home club, Saratoga Comedy Works and Albany Funny Bone. But then I was walking on Broadway at Saratoga and a guy outside the club of Saratoga was like, oh, we have open mic nights, come on in. And then I walked in and I just saw guys and girls just like, write, like do acts. And I was like, this is I had no idea you could just do that. I had no idea. So I didn't know that you could just go to open mic and do comedy before that.
You didn't know how like accessible it was. You mean it sort of seemed like this thing that some people do magically,
right?
But how?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I had a similar experience where I always thought comedy was so amazing, but I never knew how one would even do that. I kind of thought you were just like born and you were chosen almost. By the seems way, like this.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of outsiders feel like that, right? Like, especially if you're not in an artsy city, you're like, okay, I had no idea how you would do that because it's like a small town or whatever. And that's most America, right? Like, there are like few great, like a lot lively cities, and then you can get into the arts or whatever. So you have to move to the big cities. But like in the smaller towns, you don't really know. There's like one or two or three open mics, whatever. Right. And there's like a lot of variety. By the way, for the viewers, it feels like we're in the same room. You're just next to the door and I'm next to a wall.
It really does look like that with your mirror. Like, we both look like we're kind of in like dorm rooms or like student,
hi, Isabel.
Student housing. Yeah, we're just pretending it's virtual because of the pandemic.
We don't want to be seen together. That would be awkward.
Oh man, I lost my train of thought. I gotta say, I was like really, I had this whole anxiety attack, not attack, but before we did the podcast, because I had asked for your number on Instagram because we're doing a show together soon. You and I are like new friends, so I didn't have your number yet, but we like know each other. We've seen each other.
Yeah.
And you gave it to me, and then I like wrote it down in my phone and texted you that I was going to be late to do your show.
Yeah.
And you wrote back, no rush. So I was like, okay, I know that's Shafi's number. I like got it down right. But then I like texted you to do the podcast.
Yeah.
And then you weren't responding. And I was like, what if that's not Shafi? What if like some guy or a girl got like a text from someone like, hey, I'm going to be late to your show. And they were just like, no rush. Like let me just ease this random person's anxiety.
Right. Actually, you can come whenever. We actually have like a table waiting for you. You probably thought like if the person didn't know who you are, and let's say, oh, you're late, and I always see my friends being late, so I want to make sure that I am a good civilian, so I'll write back, no rush, person.
Yeah, like if you get like a text clearly from the wrong person, just like make them feel okay.
Yeah, that's the lesson. That's the lesson I think we all have learned today.
I was like, what if this person's like continuing to mess with me and they're like, ooh, they want me to do their podcast and like, I'll like send them a Zoom link or something. And I make up all these narratives in my head.
Yeah. I think Aparna had a great joke about anxiety. It's a bad improv team who plays out all the scenarios. That's what it's like, so funny, but it's such a good way to capture it. But it is like you just do like a never ending scenes in your head. It's like, what's gonna happen?
I know. I heard someone say about anxiety recently, if you're anxious, it means it hasn't happened yet.
Mm. Of course. Yeah.
Which is like, well, but
anxiety is like, future driven, right? And sadness is past driven. Present is a gift, which is the saying, I think.
It's a gift. I love that.
Well, that's why it's called present, right? That's the cliche thing that people say.
Oh, I didn't even get the pun. I'm so stupid. But I want to get back to your first time doing stand-up. But before we do that, with the anxiety thing, I was trying to think, okay, well, what if I like found out I had a terrible illness?
Yeah.
Couldn't I be anxious about that with it happening? But then I guess technically the anxiety is, oh, am I going to get like worse?
Right.
Am I never going to get better? So it is still technically always the future, whatever you're anxious about, right?
For sure. Yeah. Because like everything, like anxiety is like what's going to happen. That's pretty much what you're playing out. Like even when you're trying to sleep and you're like, oh, if I don't sleep early, I'm going to wake up late. If I sleep too late, I'm going to wake up later and later. And then your brain's like, I want to sleep now, but you're like anxious, so you can't sleep. It's like same thing with diet. You're like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to eat today. I should eat this so that I feel better later. And then you eat something else and then you feel guilty about it. It's like, I shouldn't have done that. Now I need to go on a run, and you don't go on a run because you're lazy and you just wasted your entire day.
Oh my God, you just described me. For me, if I'm not sleeping, not only am I like, I'm going to be tired tomorrow, I'm like, I'm going to die. I'm going to somehow not sleep enough and eventually just die.
Yeah.
So, do you deal with anxiety like that?
By the way, I have never like, I want to see a documentary about people who just dies because they don't sleep well. That would be a fun thing to watch. I was like, oh, there's like 5 people in Kenya and 2 in Missouri. They have the same genetics and they can't sleep and we need to learn about them.
Well, you and I are both very influenced by documentaries, we've learned.
Oh, for sure. I love them. I hate them, actually. I've never smiled during a documentary. But you're saying about... I think especially because we're stand-ups, it's a part and parcel of our life, being anxious. Especially because, you know, it's like, you know, like before I started doing stand-up, I used to be on LinkedIn and I would see my friends on, like, being CEOs. They're like CEOs already. I'm like, we just graduated. How are you already a CEO? You know what I mean? It's like, right. I want to be that CEO. And it's like you see other people and you get distracted by the noise and then you forget what makes you happy. So you're going to do all the different things, but you don't realize, I don't care. Like, it's more like a show that I'm doing right now. But what makes me happy? So I try to be mindful of that I know there's a lot of distractions. I know there's a lot of things I could be doing. But everything you do is opportunity cost to something else you're missing out on. So it's really about what connects with you. So I try to minimize the anxiety by just trying to be like, oh, okay, but, you know, I can do this, but will this bring me joy? And then I try to minimize the distraction. Distractions are what causes my anxiety because I go online or whatever and then I see a million people doing a million different things and I'm like, oh, I want to do all of that. But then I like run scenarios. Like if I did this, I have to do that. Like if, for example, TikTok. If I do TikTok, right. I have to do this kind of videos, this kind of hashtag, this kind of timing. If I do Reels, I have to do this. If I do a pod, I have to do this. If I do YouTube, I have to do... There's so many different... platforms and I have to run ideas like, oh, what if I'm left behind in the comedy scene because I'm not doing any of that? But then I have to like ask myself, what do I really want to do and the impact I want to leave behind?
And I really think these different platforms all have different... It's like the Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. I was just talking about this with my roommate, this quote mm-hmm. from Marshall McLuhan about, you know, even if you're getting really good content from TikTok...
Yeah,
it's still a fucking TikTok. Like, yeah. It's still this poisonous, rapidly changing, like attention destroying. Yeah. I mean, it's just awful in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved how you mentioned that you were going on LinkedIn and seeing like, oh, they're a CEO already. Because I always think of this sort of online jealousy as just something for creative people to worry about. Like, oh, how did they get a special already? Or how did they... But it's exactly. In every field.
Every field.
Even like...
Yeah. Exactly. Like my parents didn't have to worry about that. That's like, you know what I mean? They're anxious mostly about their future in the sense that, you know, if they will retire with a good pension. But that's like, you know, that's like everyone... All of us, plus we have added tension of, oh, we're getting left behind because, you know, all of our circle. But that's the thing. Like, it's all about the reference point, right? If you think you are deserving of something, that's the point when you start getting jealous. So the way to minimize that, I think, is that not expect anything and then just do the work and see what happens. Obviously, that's really hard, harder than...
Yeah, how do you do that, Shop? I feel like you're the only one... Whenever I talk to you, you seem so level-headed and like you've just got it.
It's all
down.
It's all I'm faking it so hard. but that's the only thing. Like, you know, you probably know about, you know, Joe. You're friends with Joe List, and then I am also a big proponent of Stoicism, and that's kind of the, you know, teachings of Stoicism. It's just like worrying about things you can control, and I have to remind myself every day. It's like you wake up and you have to like, oh, that's fine. Like, you know, like I know everyone is doing a lot of million things and. But like we are all going to die in like, you know, 20, 30 years from now, most of us will be forgotten, right? So like what is the kind of energy I want to put behind? And that's more important to me than anything else.
Wait, you think we're going to die in like 20 to 30 years?
No, after we die, after the 20, 30 years of our death, no one's going to remember us. You know what I mean?
I do this thing where I think people have information that I don't have.
Yeah.
Especially during COVID, I would like panic.
Oh, and yeah, you didn't hear about the COVID-21 yet? That's going to come out.
Like, if someone seems anxious, I'm like, well, they must know something I don't know.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait, what news do you have, Shafi? We're all dying right. In 30 years?
No, it is true, though. Like, whenever you're talking to a friend and they seem sad, and you're like, I'm just having a great day. Why are you sad, Nick? You know, what do you know? You know what I mean? It's like, tell me. And they're like, oh, it's like my cat. Oh, cat. Okay, that's fine then.
Well, it just goes to show that it really is, and it sounds kind of trite, but it really is just always what you make of it, pretty much, barring like some really extreme, terrible circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're just living in your head.
You are.
You're a figment of your imagination.
Do you think that did stand-up help you with your anxiety in any way?
100%. I was very anxious before stand-up, in the sense that I just didn't, I couldn't ground myself. You know what I mean?
Right.
I needed like a thing to do all the time, and stand-up gave me that. It was such a control freak. Like people who love control, they obviously love stand-up. It's like I can control the writing, I can control the performance, I can control my YouTube special someday whenever I come. You know what I mean? So it's like I can do the work and keep doing it.
Right. And stand-up is such a, you know, difficult kind of almost masochistic pursuit in a lot of ways. And I think you almost have to be so anxious to be able to put up with it, because you have to be so anxious for stand-up comedy to be the thing that eases your anxiety. Because if you think about it, it is a very, like, to a quote normal person, stand-up seems like a very anxiety-inducing thing to do. You're getting on stage, it's public speaking.
Yeah.
You bomb a lot. Lots of things can go wrong, heckling. Yeah. Yeah. Yet for me, and I think probably for you and most stand-ups, we know.
Yeah.
It's the best we feel when we're on stage, even when things are kind of going badly. Like last night, now because of COVID, they give everyone their own mics at the clubs and you have to plug in.
And
I had a mic I had a shitty mic, and it started like making all these popping noises as I went. And then the host had to come up and give me like a different mic, and it was just, you know, awful. But I was still just like, whatever. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. Anything else? Like if you're like, you know, a doctor and you're like, you know, cutting up your patient and you just like completely mess up. You're like cutting in the wrong place. Your nurse comes up like, what are you doing? It's like, you will probably have a panic attack. But as stand-ups, everything can go wrong on stage. We're just like so calm and say, yeah, it's fine.
Right. And when you first did an open mic, did you have jokes you had like written already, or were you just kind of like seeing what worked in the moment?
I had a few thoughts, and then I never really call a lot of comics to call their jokes at first. I always call them thoughts, because if they're jokes, I already know they work. You know what I mean? Like they're thoughts.
I love that.
Let them play out at least 10 times before I can call them jokes.
That is funny when like someone gets on stage and says some like half-baked premise. I'm like, well, that joke didn't work. Yeah, it's like, because it's not a joke.
Yeah. I used to like riff off that. It's like comics will come on stage and they're like, oh, so I'm going to try out some new jokes. I'm like, let us decide if they're jokes. It's like, what do you mean? They're not jokes yet, dude. They're new. Okay. So you are here for a reason.
Yeah. I remember someone at an open mic, I was like asking him advice. He was like, you know, 2 years in and I was 3 months in, and I was like, what do you think of my stuff? You know? And he was like, well, they're not jokes. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, there's no punchline.
Right.
And I was like, oh, a punchline.
Oh, so it's not like just amusing things you say on stage? Oh.
Well, because so many of our favorite stand-ups, the great stand-ups, they're so fluid in their delivery that you don't realize things are punchlines. You don't see the structure in it because it's all so natural.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Once you do like 2 + 2 = 4, you don't really know why is 2 + 2 = 4. You really need to understand the theories of math. That's the same with stand-up. It's like, oh, it's just so obvious, but it's not, because there's like hidden, you know, structures to the punchlines that they're putting out there.
Right. If you watch like a Gary Goldman set or a Bill Burr set, both of them, I feel like it's very like natural two very different comedians. Oh, but for sure.
Both from Boston. They both came
from Boston. Yeah. And it's fun to go through and be like, now knowing what we know, like, oh, there's the punchline. Right. And it makes me laugh less, unfortunately, but it is very interesting to watch them.
Yeah, because that's the thing, like you realize with stand-up, though, over time, you just laugh less. You just laugh at the sillier stuff, you know, the unexpected things people say. But like when it's like you see the structure coming, you're like, oh, that's a good joke, but you don't really laugh, you know. I don't know if like musicians do that. That's a good, but they're like, they don't applaud anymore.
Well, it's such a different, the music I play is so different in the sense that I'm often watching people perform other people's music. So there's so many levels of like, oh, who's responsible for what thing that I like right now? Like, it's either like, oh, they're just an amazing technician and interpreter,
yeah,
or, oh, I love this piece, let me talk to the composer after,
yeah,
or they're a dead composer maybe, so then let me just go listen to that piece again. It's like, oh, I love that piece, let me go listen to someone else play it later. Like, I don't need like their rendition,
yeah,
because it's just whatever the Beethoven quartet sonata, yeah, whatever you're listening to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I wanted to ask is, when you did your first open mic, did you bomb? And if you did you get right back up the next night, or did you take some time? Or
well I started in upstate, so you cannot really get back up next night because we had like 3 open mics a week.
Oh, right.
So it was, I was talking to someone about this, like, how do you count when you started doing comedy? Is it like when you move to the city, when you're getting up every night, or is it like once a week? I don't think once a week really counts, but you know. It's like you're just like, oh, this is something I go and hang out with my friends that I see every day,
right,
or every week. So I went up, I bombed, obviously. It was mostly like, you know, observations and dichotomies between America and Bangladesh. And like looking back at the set, I'm like, oh, like I had some ideas that I thought would be amusing to bring up. But it was more like me reporting on it without like really adding anything to it. Do you know what I mean? It was like more like a kid telling you a story about, oh, these are the things that I find weird.
Right.
Like you know, like our any comedy comes from when we find something ridiculous and then we add our nuggets to it to make it a joke. And that's the part I was missing. I wasn't adding a lot of my nuggets. It was nuggets that I got from McDonald's and I was sharing it with the crowd.
great analogy.
And I bombed, but I taped my set, which I'm going to sell as an NFT someday. If yeah, someone buys
it. I just
it.
Learned about NFTs.
Oh, it's the best. You got to get in now when it's hot.
Okay.
So I have my tape, and which it's cringeworthy. Like my body posture is weird. My mic holding is so bizarre, but it's like a good thing I have. And it's just like, oh my God, I was so, I still like was smiling. I was delivering it like with confidence, but it just like looked off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's when you know you love it, when you're kind of like doing a bad set and bombing, but you're still just like, this is the best time of my life. Like, yeah. I got to do that again.
Yeah, I got addicted really fast because I just like the idea of controlling. You know, I love that I can just like ride and get up and not have to worry about a lot of things. That's why I think stand-up was something that I was always attracted to, because it's just, oh, I'll just like go up, and then I kept doing it, never stopped.
It is such a beautiful, for lack of a better word, but beautiful art form, in the sense that you get to just be creative in your own head during the day and then immediately go try it that night and maybe get a laugh and be like, wow, this whole world that I just created is like having an effect right now. There's no other, you don't have to like get camera crews. You don't have to collaborate. You don't have to wait for anybody. It's just like, go. And
exactly.
I think that's what I love about it. I mean, I think there's joy in collaboration.
Right.
But I think good collaboration is so hard to come by.
Right. Exactly. People, like in the I think the the TV show I'm Dying Up Here, or the book itself, like one of the dialogues is you know, like they're like, you know, TV stars are different performers, and then there are stand-ups, and she was talking to someone about it, and she's like, what do we get? And she said, we get the moment, you know, like you're there with the people, and that's the most beautiful thing, really. It's like your human interactions, and you're just like living it up, and no two sets are ever really the exact same, which is the beautiful part, I think, about stand-up.
It is. And so I also count amount of time doing stand-up as like when you start doing it every night. So how many years have you been doing it every night now?
Every night, I think probably when I moved to the city. So that would be like 2019 September. Before then, I was probably getting up like, you know, 3-4 times a week.
Okay.
So I don't
know. So you're like still very new in a lot of senses.
Yeah, yeah. Because especially with the pandemic, because I had to take time off from, I think, March to June, and that's when the park stuff and all of that came back. But that was still, I was like doing a lot of Zoom, so there was like 4 months that we all had to kind of stop and be like, we don't know what's going on.
I think I probably collected a total of like 8 months for me not doing. I did less than a lot of people too in terms of the park stuff, like,
yeah,
which I never thought I would take that much time off. It's wild.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're so funny, especially. I didn't know that you had been doing it that short a time.
Oh, you're so sweet. And you're so
no, cool. Really. Like, but shut up. Well, you just kind of appeared all of a sudden because, you know, we met through Joe List.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I feel like we're both, you know, his little friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like his minions.
So I'm going to tell him that. But what I also am interested in is that you work full time as an engineer. And what is that like? Do you get fulfillment from that? Is it creative in any ways? Like, how is that for you?
Yeah, if I had to do anything, I'd probably be in the sciences because it's like, especially like in the field I'm in, it's very like fast paced because semiconductors is the reason. It's not my thing, but it's like the industry itself is the reason that we have made so much progress in the last 20, 30 years. Because it's like, if you just imagine when you're a kid, you had big TVs, big computers, and they had like no processing power. But now your phone does the same, even better than they could do. So it's all about the silicon chips that we make and how fast they are, the processing power of these devices. People don't really like think about like how fast we have moved from those big, gigantic computers to this small device. And that's all because of semiconductor processing power. And that's, so I'm really, really enjoy being part of that team, like the gigantic team around the world who collaborate and make things happen. So that's really fun.
Well, the nature of technological improvements makes it so that it's exponentially improving at an exponential rate because you use the new technology to make the new technology, right?
Exactly. Exactly. There's it's called Moore's Law. Like the Moore, he suggested that every 2 years we'll decrease the size of our transistors so we can fit more transistors in your phone or any device so that you can do more and more processing.
Right. We're not just making like the new iPhone with a hammer, you know? We're not just like... That was a stupid, stupid image. I like why you brought up that people don't really appreciate the technology and like the chips or the silicon, whatever you're talking. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Which is such a funny idea because
it's Pringles. There's so many. You can't have one. You're just like, oh, give me more chips. Give me more chips.
But there are these people working so hard.
Yeah.
And who have created stuff that's so amazing.
No one knows them.
No one gives a shit. We're just like, I just need this phone. I need it to do this, whatever. It's probably such a small amount of people who actually have a true appreciation for like the beauty of what has been created. It's like we were talking about the other night with Jake when we were out having burritos and we were saying like, nobody cares about stand-up.
Right. It's really the field you're in, you love it, and then no one else does. You know what I mean? There are very few people who has a broader... It's usually when you're the top of the top, like 1%, that's when people know them and like them. But there's like 99% who are doing the exact same thing and try and like creating and curating, but they never really get the spotlight. And that's fine if they do it for the love. Like if you just think of all of us as creators, as a liquid, and we're just adding to the vessel. We're just slowly adding to all different. Because if you're original as a creative person, you don't really need to be popular. You just add, because like whenever someone sees your art and it's different and unique, you're leaving your mark behind, and that's the goal, right? You just want to do something that's very you and unique, and no one can replicate that.
Yeah, I think creativity at its best, if you're really making something original and feels true to you, I think by nature you're not going to care as much about its reception, or at least that's been my experience. If I make something that I just know is like that I like, or I don't care as much if people watch it or enjoy it.
Exactly.
And at the same time, I also think
it's like when you make a baby, you're like, I don't care if other people like it, but it's like, you know, my baby, so I'll take care of it.
Well, I don't know. I might care if people like my baby.
Right.
But so what's, as an engineer, what do you actually do? Like, what is a daily?
So like, you know, engineering can be anything, right? It's a different field. Like, I used to be a process engineer, so for example, like I would do a lot of experimental designs. So for semiconductors, if I have to like, you know, explain it simply, we have chips, right? So we have new technology that's coming up, for example, and we want to see how we can make them better, run better, faster. So we would take that device that we're trying to test and test it in a equipment and then do different kind of variations. So for example, when you're doing a stand-up set, right, you want to try out different flows, different jokes in different parts of your set to see what flows better, the best. And that's pretty much what engineering is. You take different parameters, for example, how fast, how many do you need for it to be that fast? Can you have the same processing power with the reduced amount of the resources that you're using? So you take different variables and you tweak them, and then you run a few times, and then you gather the data, you see the data, and then you reevaluate. So you just do different iterations of different. It's very scientific. Like stand up is very scientific, and that's why I love it so much. So right. I feel like my engineering background actually helps me a lot to understand comedy, because I can decode structures and try to learn from that and try to make my stand-up better.
Right, that trial and error.
Yeah, that's all it is. That's all science is, that's all comedy is, and that's why it's so like scientific.
It's kind of all anything is, and yeah. It's so interesting, because when you're in like a flow state, creativity can feel like this sort of indescribable thing.
Mm.
But when you pare it down to its most like raw, whatever it is,
yeah,
which is, I think, always trial and error.
Yeah.
That is such a clinical kind of random thing. You're like, okay, right. Well, what about this? What about this?
Right.
Did that work? Okay, that works. Okay, great. I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
What about this tag? Oh, what if I say it slower? Okay, what if I say it faster? Like, it's kind of like not, it is almost just you're trying to discover these things. And, right. And I think about it sometimes, how is discovery the same thing as creativity? Because so much of creativity feels like just discovery.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
And just putting in the time. I don't know what I'm saying exactly.
No. I completely agree. But I think stand-up is, when it comes to art, stand-up is the most scientific. Because it is really, you're really in, because you can't really make it scientific. If you look at the data, right? If you look at this joke, you did it 10 times. How many times did you get a laugh? So you have like a percent of time it works. That's very scientific. You can literally take a decibel meter with you and measure the amount of laughter you're getting in a joke, and then add that to your Excel spreadsheet to see how many times that's working. You can take it to a different states to see the sample size and the demographic and people who can relate to, like especially when you go to like a small towns and you have the joke about documentary and they're like, what are you talking about? We don't watch documentaries here. So you can really, really be granular with your jokes and break it down. Oh, this works here, this works. And that's the most, like, no art form is like that, I don't think. Like a song, obviously, like, you know, country song works better in the South or whatever, but you don't really do those minuscule, like, obviously I'm biased because I love stand-up a lot. So right. I feel like stand-up is better.
Stand-up is the most scientific, greatest.
Yeah, I do think it is more scientific than other, because like other art forms, you cannot really measure it like that. You know what I mean? Like if you're singing a song, people always applaud, but no bits always get applause, you know what I mean? So it's like, there is a reason behind that.
Well, is it the only, my instinct is to say it's the only art form that requires an immediate response in the moment.
Yeah.
I think. And also, this is actually Joe List and I were talking about this on his episode a while back, this Seinfeld quote.
Yeah.
Stand-up is the only art that when it doesn't work, it ceases to be that art.
Yeah.
I
completely get it. Yeah, because it's not comedy anymore. It's a TED talk. Yeah, it becomes some other art form.
And right, I mean, right. Obviously, comedy is subjective, because I'll do a set in Brooklyn, with a bunch of jokes that kill.
Yeah,
and then I'll go do that set in New Brunswick.
Yeah,
not speaking from any particular recent experience.
Yeah,
and we'll do it to silence, and it's exactly. Like, well, okay. Obviously, that's subjective, because neither of these people are wrong.
Right.
Maybe I like one of these groups of people better, but
right.
It's
also like targeted ads, right? You're targeting your ads wrong. So you don't really understand them. But at the same time, do you want to be you all the time? You know, there's so many things you have to think about as a stand-up that you don't have to think. You go, you play music, you can play that music, whatever. No one's going to come and hate on you because there are like no opinions behind it. But stand-up, right. There's like opinions behind it and they judge you for those opinions. It's more personal at a visceral level.
It's hard because my instinct, and I think a lot of people's instincts, is to, you know, this sort of perfectionist, like, okay, well, they don't like, this crowd doesn't like these jokes. Okay, so I have to do this set the next night for the same club. Can I change? Should I change something? Should I, like, be different? And it's like, yes, you should always be, like, improving your jokes, but you can't really change your persona because ultimately that's going to be inauthentic. But that's my instinct, you know? I'm like, okay, well, they don't like that I'm, like a sad girl. Maybe I should, like, up the energy and be, like, more peppy. But it's that's not really me.
Right, so. Right. There's no point in doing that. It's just you have to probably, like, understand, you know, like, maybe they're, like, jokes they liked the previous night and maybe upload them first. And then see, you all rewind them over and then you bring the sad version of yourself. You're like, ha, I tricked you. I'm still sad.
Right. Yeah, there are tactics that can keep you true to yourself.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's great. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Do you find that now doing stand-up, it's changed your approach to engineering? Has it sort of like reignited anything or made you see things differently?
Engineering has helped me with stand-up, but stand-up hasn't helped me with engineering. But stand-up, you know, helps you in everything else in your life. So stand-up helps me in life, so that helps me at my job, so that helps, I guess, you know what I mean? But like engineering is a lot of problem solving. So you see a problem, you try to solve it, and that's what stand-up is. You have a point of view and you're trying to prove it. It's like a problem statement and you're like, oh, you don't understand what I'm saying. How about this example? How is this now? And then you just like, you know, try different things and then you prove your point. It's like a math. Right. It's like, it's very, and if I didn't do engineering, I probably wouldn't see it like that, but because I have that discipline, it makes me see it as like a math problem every time. So that
do you listen back to every set?
I'm taping every set. If I do like a mic or whatever, I will like listen back to it. But the new jokes that I try, I definitely listen to those. Because, you know, you kind of, unless I'm adding like an old tag, like a new tag to an older joke, I'll listen to those. So anything that's new, I'll listen to. But if it's like something that I've been doing for like a year and a half, and I know that joke works every time, I'm not going to bother. I'll like fast forward my sets. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll do that sometimes. Yeah. But part of me also does, because I mean, the audiences are so different each time. Yeah. And sometimes I'm like, well, maybe I should change this joke that's been working for 2 years. I don't know.
Like you want to try one new tag. I try those. Like I'll try a new tag. I'm like, you didn't like that at all. Like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I never feel like when I add a tag in like such a clinical way, it never seems to work. Whenever I'm listening back, occasionally, like I'll hear a tag.
Yeah.
You like hear it. You're like, oh, that's what I would say next.
Yeah.
And then that usually works.
Yeah.
But if I like search for like this addition to something or like try to like play around with the words and make some sort of, it never gets the pop I want it to. It might get a laugh, but not like fucking funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How do you come up with tags? Like what's your process with that?
My goal is every set I want to try at least one new line. Doesn't matter what it is. It could be a completely new joke, but it has to, or like a tag to a new old joke, but I have to try one new thing. It could be tiniest thing, doesn't matter. That kind of excites me to keep doing stand-up because it's just like a novelty of it, just going on stage and doing it. So for tags, like now, like, you know, I'm going back to things I wrote in like, you know, 2018, and I was not, you know, just starting out, and I was not the, you know, obviously I sucked. So I'm going back and trying to salvage premises to see if there's anything there. So like those are kind of like, you know, reworking jokes that never really worked. So that has been kind of my goal now, just like, you know, re-adding stuff. And for, you know, older jokes, what kind of tags do I do? I try to sit down with them and try to like look at the news if there's anything there recent to add to it. If not, I'll try to see if I can. Because like at times, like you know, obviously, you know, being a newer stand-up, you have jokes that work, but then you didn't really know why it worked. But now that I have more of a, like understanding of the structure, I'm like, oh, look, but I can add this analogy here, or add this counterpoint here, or you know, add like a point of view of how the other person is reacting to this thing I'm saying, right? Or a crowd member would react. So you can add like a few different things around this joke that works to see if it's adding to it. So that's what I'm trying to do, like, you know, going back and seeing that jokes that have worked or like tying things together, like separate jokes to see if they flow together. So that's been something else I tried to do and like to interject in my sets.
I love the process of tying things together, and I'm working on a longer set right now. Yeah. And I was sort of like, okay, well, what jokes go together? What could be like weaved into like one bigger bit kind of?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that. I love the process of like tying things and then like having a callback, and that just like, oh, so good. Such a fun feeling.
I love callbacks. I was obsessed with them when I first started. I had like too many callbacks. Yeah, it was like people were just like, all right.
Yeah, we get it. You know how to write.
But it's musical.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, and I'm a musician, and I love the, like, you know, the recapitulation.
And audiences love it. Comics probably don't love it, but audiences love when you have a good callback.
Oh, yeah. When I didn't do comedy and I would watch specials, if someone made a callback at the end, I was like, how did they do that?
Right. You're such a genius. Yeah. I'm very attracted to those two. Like, I would be blown away by whenever I would see a callback.
I just came up with a new callback that I'm so excited.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just feels so good. I'm like, But that was also what you said about going back to older jokes.
Yeah.
That was advice I was given too. And that if you have an idea, you might just not be funny enough to do it yet.
Exactly.
Which is such a nice kind of beautiful thing to think about, like, one day I will be able to like express this and make it funny.
Right. At the same time, you also gather other knowledge of life and the world, and maybe at that time you didn't have that example, now you do, and that joke is going to work now, and that's kind of beautiful because like things have happened in the world that makes that joke relevant now. So it's like anything you write, that's why, like, you know, note keeping is so important. It's like, write everything down that you think is remotely funny. Even if it doesn't work, maybe in 3 years later, you can come back to it.
Right. Yeah. Although, I mean, I have like so many notebooks where I'm like, ugh, am I ever going to actually open that notebook again?
Yeah. I type everything in OneNote. So I have like every month, every thought I had in every month in like a documented way, so I can just like refer back to, I can go back to like 2017 October and tell you what jokes I wrote that month.
Or like, based on what you were like going through, you're like, there's a lot of stuff about
whatever it was, I put it down.
Oh man, you're more organized than I am. I'm very organized with my physical belongings, but digital and like I just have a lot of things all over the place.
I don't have anything that's like physical, because I know a friend who had, early on when I started comedy, he lost his notebook. I was like, I'm never gonna go through that. I'm gonna type everything down, and everything was typed, and I feel like it's in the cloud, so I'll probably have it forever, hopefully, unless it goes down.
I need to handwrite though sometimes, but I think I have most things like backed up in some note on my phone or some cloud somewhere.
Yeah.
But so the last thing I'll ask is, do you struggle with any kind of performance anxiety? Do you get nervous on stage? Does it help you? Have you ever had like a bad experience with it?
Like performing? Yeah, I get anxious when I go to like very small towns, and it's the demographic is mostly white and older people. And I tried to, like, I had like a show in, you know, like a small town in PA, and it was phenomenal, right? But like, you really, I have to act more confident. I tried to be like, oh, we're just gonna have a good time, because like it is like a thing that I have to keep in mind, that those people probably have never interacted with someone of my ethnicity and background. And it is definitely interesting to me. And I think it's my duty to share this knowledge and my culture with them and just be buddies with these people. But a lot of people at sight might take me as like someone they don't want to be friends with. But that's the challenge and the beauty of those shows. And I have learned over the years, because I used to do so many like small town shows in upstate, and you learn over the years of like how to actually do a good set. And that also, like, you know, like jokes that work in every room, that helps you kind of learn those. So I definitely got better with time. But like, I'm very aware of my ethnicity and, you know, my background when I go to, but like, you know, like cities that they don't care. Like, you say whatever and it's right. Fine. But that's something I work with for sure.
What's the most uncomfortable place you've ever performed stand-up in terms of that?
It was like a small town in Messina, New York. And I think it was like a casino, next to a casino. And it was just like my first time doing like a very small town. And it was like a drive, but it ended up being really fun. The people are very nice. And that's when I realized that, you know, you just like have to be confident and do your jokes and you'll be fine, because they're here to like, they don't have anything going on in their lives. They want comedy. So just give it to them. That's what, right. I learned. Yeah. People love, like on the road, people love comedy. If you like do a decent job, they are dying of, because they haven't heard comedy. So they're just like, everything is so funny to them.
Yeah. I'm like going to do some shows in Utah soon.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And this isn't from my experience, but everyone I tell that to who's done shows in Utah is like, you're going to have such a great time. Yeah. They love to laugh down there. Yeah, like, yeah. It's going to be good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you wouldn't expect that, but that's the reality. People are just like trying to have a good time. That's all people.
Right.
People just want to have a good time, and that, you know, they want to learn about you, but it's like, you also have to be willing to let that guard down and be like, I'm here to have a good time too. That's what I learned.
Having a good time on stage, it's hard to sometimes seem like you're having a good time.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
stage.
Like, I feel like I recently am trying to be more present, and that makes me like, you know, like our buddy Joe, he is very aware of what's going on, every single line that he says out of his mouth. And I think that's a good thing, like especially when you go to like a room that you might think that you're not going to do well, because then they realize that you're very aware of yourself, and that brings them, gets them to be more at ease, and that might help with your set. So like that's you having fun, because you're commenting on what's going on. It's like, it's silly and it's fun.
Right. Well, I always feel much more at ease when I run into you, Shafi, and talking to you. You're just so one of my favorite people on the scene. Really funny. Just a great guy. This is my plug for Shafi. I also do an intro. So,
I also feel the same way. Whenever I see you, Isabel, it's just like you're very open, very willing to share and take in. And
I'm willing.
Yeah, yeah. And your presence is very like calming. Like whenever I see you, I'm like, oh, I have a friend around. I'll be fine. Like if I need something, I can just chat up with this musician great stand-up comedian. And you're so talented and everyone loves you. I've never heard anything bad spoken about you. So you're doing great and it's wonderful. And congratulations on everything you have gotten and you'll get. So
oh, amazing. Thank you. You make me tear up, Shafi. Jeez. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for doing the podcast, Shafi.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's such a fun time. Like every time I talk to you, it's so fun.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. Likewise. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening. For more, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter, both at IsabelHagen_, and sign up for my mailing list at IsabelHagen.com. And as always, please rate and review the podcast. Thank you so much, and take care.